Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin, and we're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, June 20th, 2018. We begin with the news section. White makes right. North Carolina's right-wing militia activists take up Trump's fear of a migrant Muslim planet. Inside the Greensboro Coliseum on June 14, 2016, then-presidential candidate Donald Trump unleashed one of his more memorably over-the-top campaign promises. We're going to start winning again. We're going to win at every single level. We're going to win so much that you're going to beg me, please, Mr. President, we're winning so much, we cannot stand it. Please, a little less winning, Mr. President. The speech coming 2 days after the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando dripped with menace. The candidate veered abruptly from his theme, jobs and trade, to read from a Washington Times report connecting shooter Omar Mateen and Islamic extremists in Afghanistan. Later, Trump read a poem called The Snake, which he used as an allegory for treacherous outsiders who exploit the kindness of benefactors. He said, "Now you have to think of this in terms of Islamic terror. You have to think of it in terms of our border. You have to think of it in terms of all the people that are crossing, that are criminals, that are killing people and hurting people." Outside the Coliseum, protesters held signs reading, "Trump makes America hate again, and a vote for Trump is a vote for fear, bigotry, racism, and fascism," while supporters waved Confederate and Gadsden flags. Right-wing militias interposed themselves between Trump supporters and protesters, and hundreds of police officers stood ready in case of a disturbance. A dozen protesters were arrested, both for disrupting the rally inside and for misdemeanors like disorderly conduct, although the event remained largely peaceful. As the rally was winding down, Rod Weber, a documentary filmmaker from Boston, intercepted Jason Posmore, a militia activist from Brown Summit. A video of the encounter posted on YouTube begins with Posmore giving a perfunctory after report, "We're happy it turned out peaceful, and no violence as of yet, so hopefully we can all go home and see our families," said Posmore, sunglasses propped on the camouflage bill of his hat. "And that's all that matters." Posmore's friend, Manuel Luxton, with wraparound shades and a walrus mustache, stood on the sidewalk holding a Gadsden flag. "You got anything?" Weber asked Luxton. "In the Fed," Luxton reposed. "Stop the war crimes against the people of Novorossiya." Trump's seeming admiration for Russian President Vladimir Putin was one of many threads in the campaign, but the term Novorossiya is still unfamiliar to most Americans. Mostly that's because it's not a real country, but a relic of Imperial Russia, situated north of the Black Sea. The territory was seized from the Ottoman Empire by Russia in the late 18th century, then became a part of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic under the Soviet Union, and remained part of the independent Ukraine after the Cold War. Before Luxton could expand on his sympathetic view toward Russia's expansionist aims, someone caught Passmore's eyes, a man he thought was a federal agent. "Ports, forts, and 10 square miles, you SOB," Passmore yelled. For far-right militia activists, this phrase is fundamental doctrine. The Constitution grants Congress the power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district, not exceeding 10 square miles, as may, by cession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of government of the United States. The 10th Amendment, reserving all powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution to the states, in turn, invalidates the authority of the FBI and other federal agencies according to the logic of far-right constitutionalists. Anything else is a violation of the U.S. Constitution and is a tyrannical act of the federal government, Passmore said, and it should be dealt with appropriately. As the militia activist took leave of the filmmaker, Passmore, a former military contractor in Afghanistan, issued a parting shot at a cluster of protesters who had been arguing against Trump's stance toward Syrian refugees. "Muslims don't coexist," Passmore shouted. A debate ensued, drawing the militia activists back into the fray. Luxton fell into a rant stitched out of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. "They're trying to start a war against Russia, who's never done anything against us, despite numerous provocations," he said. "Despite U.S. and London bankers backing the non-Russian Bolsheviks, who murdered more than 100 million Russians, mostly Christians, that's just swept under the rug of history." Trump's paeans to the forgotten people and disparagement of globalists resonate with all this alt-right view of Jewish people as a powerful manipulative force shaping the course of history to undermine the white Christian homeland. Fear of Muslims, refugees, and migrants, coupled with resentment of supposed globalist elite, would build the foundation of Trumpism and supply themes that would reverberate back and forth between a future president who rails against the deep state and a right-wing militia movement already prone to conspiratorial views of a federal government. 3 days after the Trump rally, Passmore posted a photo of himself on Facebook with Luxton and other friends outside the Greensboro Coliseum, writing, "This will be the start of something great." He elaborated in a separate comment, "GCM, that's the Guilford County Militia, how does that sound to everyone?" With Trump's election, the aspirations of newly emboldened white nationalists transitioning from internet trolls to street fighters would soon collide with a re-energized anti-fascist resistance, culminating in fierce clashes and a deadly car-ramming attack after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, in August. The new alt-right shares an activist ecosystem with the older far-right militia movement, which emerged in the 90s in response to federal agencies' enforcement actions at Ruby Ridge in northern Idaho and the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas. From an illogical standpoint, militia activists identify as patriots, constitutionalists, and 3%ers, an allusion to the idea that only a select few colonists took up arms to overthrow British rule. It's easy for those on the outside to paint the militia movement with a broad brush, that they're all animated by racism or white supremacy. The truth is more complex. Militia groups aren't monolithic. Some, for example, have disavowed white nationalism and struck up conversations with anti-fascists in hopes of maintaining public safety, protecting property, and upholding the First Amendment. But while it claims to be open to all races, there's no denying that the broader militia movement has provided a haven for violent white supremacists. Many militia groups have embraced the same causes as white nationalists, including the veneration of Confederate monuments and hostility toward Muslims. They also tend to share a hostility toward anti-fascists, which is usually repackaged in the rhetoric of anti-communists. Passmore and his associates have formed a cohesive set. Many of the individuals who showed up to the 2016 Trump rally also went to Unite the Right a year later, as well as other events focused on preserving the legacy of the Confederacy and promoting Islamophobia. A close look at their activism reveals how far-wing activists can choose from a buffet of ideologies and esoteric interests: neo-Confederate, anti-Muslim, anti-migrant, anti-Semitic, conspiratorial, anti-globalist, extreme libertarian, Second Amendment absolutist, anti-modernity, male chauvinist, and even flat earth, that every member may not share. Many of these views, particularly neo-Confederate and anti-Muslims, share currency with the Patriot movement. And for that reason, these self-styled patriots, even those who denounce white supremacy, may not recognize, or may be willfully blind to, white nationalism within their ranks, allowing resurgent white supremacists to organize and recruit from within the larger far-right universe. Jason Passmore's fluid stance on white nationalism can often be found among the hardened warriors of the militia movement. Paradoxically, as the father of biracial children, Passmore embraces a vision of racial enclaves, while professing a willingness to fight alongside both David Duke and Louis Farrakhan against a tyrannical government. Despite his disavowal of racism, Passmore has literally weaponized white nationalism by conducting firearm training with white racialist activists, including Luxton, who calls himself a national socialist, and Cody Beachy, who has publicly expressed admiration for Adolf Hitler and Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte, whose bloody war on drugs has claimed more than 12,000 lives. And Passmore has insinuated that he would be willing to use violence against federal authorities. 5 days before the 2016 Trump rally, he posted on Facebook, "Anyone that feels we should just talk on Facebook and have meetings without shooting and training for a fight is not on my sheet of music. When it comes to a fight, we will stop the blood or shoot the people that shoot at you." Beachy, who could not be reached for comment for this story, responded, "I got your six." Passmore says that shortly after the Trump rally, he received a visit from Joint Terrorist Task Force comprised of elements of FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. "They knocked on my door and wanted to talk, accused me of being a terrorist," Passmore recalls. "They asked me if I would turn in anyone who tried to coerce me or involve me in a terrorist act. I politely told them, no, I wouldn't, because they don't have any jurisdiction." Passmore says he was radicalized by the Ruby Ridge Siege, a 1992 incident in which U.S. Marshals scouted the homestead of a loner named Randy Weaver, who was wanted on gun charges in a remote corner of a northern Idaho area. A deadly shootout set in motion an 11-day siege that resulted in the death of Weaver's wife by FBI sniper fire. Now 33, he met Weaver at age 15. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Passmore has an inherent distrust of U.N. foreign policy. He believes the 9/11 attacks were an inside job. Even though he went to Afghanistan as a contractor, he did so strictly for financial reasons, he says, as his business struggled when the recession hit. He believes the military has no business in the Middle East. He even marched in Greensboro to protest the impending invasion of Iraq. "I protested the war before I went to Afghanistan," Passmore said. "I don't think we should be in Afghanistan or Iraq. It's a waste of money and lives. We shouldn't be involved in Israel or Syria. I can say firsthand I've seen our government play both sides." Passmore says he's been conducting firearms training with 4 to 7 3%ers from across the state at a time in the 2016 rally. He met Luxton 4 years prior at training with a group of North Carolina 3%ers and invited him to join him for rifle practice. Passmore says he met Beachy after the Trump rally. Following a background check to ensure that he wasn't an undercover agent, Passmore says Beachy joined the Guilford County Militia for a couple of trainings. On June 30, 2016, Passmore posted a call for open recruiting for GCM on his Facebook page. The post indicated the group was open to all, regardless of age, sex, creed, color, religion. The newly minted militia appropriated the Guilford Courthouse flag, the banner flown by patriots during the Battle of Guilford Courthouse in 1781. On Independence Day 2016, Passmore posted a photo of himself and his crew practicing riflery from a shed roof, commenting, "God, please grant us the strength and protection we will soon need. Please, protect our family from the storm they will surely be exposed to. We know this fight is righteous. Please keep us brave in the face of evil. May our bullets fly true and our friends keep us well supplied. Casey Becknell, a 43-year-old Civil War reenactor from Lexington, commented, "And may God bless Dixie through it all." Soon after Trump's election, the North Carolina-based Loyal White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan drew international headlines with a pledge to hold a victory parade. When the appointed date of December 3rd arrived, upward of 100 mostly masked far-left anti-fascists from the Triangle were waiting at the anticipated parade route in rural Caswell County, armed with aluminum baseball bats. The Loyal White Knights finally mustered a motorcade about 3 p.m., but serviced two counties away in Roxborough. Encouraged by their success, the Triangle anti-fascists turned their attention to a Confederate Memorial Day rally event organized by Alamance County, Taking Back Alamance County, or ACTBAC, that was held on May 20th of 2017. Passmore, Luxton, and a friend named Jason Campbell joined the Alamance Regulators Militia and the ACTBAC to defend the Confederate Monument in downtown Graham. With them were Becknell, the reenactor and 3%er, and Hunter Smith, a 30-year-old Denton resident who was also involved in the Civil War reenactment scene. A video posted by Ruptly, a Berlin-based video news agency that is part of the Russian slanted RT network, captured the tension as the two sides traded insults. While Left Chant says, "Down with your flag," Passmore, Luxton, Becknell, Smith, and Campbell stood in a throng of right-wing activists waving Confederate, Gadsden, and 3%er flags. Passmore carried the Guilford County courthouse battle flag. "We live in a country where the most successful demographic is Asian men," Smith shouted. "White supremacy. The most successful demographic in this county is a minority." Luxton, meanwhile, accused on Facebook. He acknowledged that white nationalist group Identity Envirups as the inspiration for the sign. Although ACT for America has publicly distanced itself from white nationalism, members of Identity Europa filled out a significant portion of the relatively small event in Raleigh. Appealing to young white men on college campuses, Identity Europa proclaims a demand that we, people of European heritage, retain demographic supermajorities in our homelands. Trading on an anti-Semitic trope, the organization's website charged that a globalist elite has relentlessly pushed for open borders and mass immigration in an attempt to import a new people who are seen as more politically malleable than Americans, particularly those of European descent. Ora Van Dietz, at the time an Identity Europa leader from Yadkin County, warned during a speech, "We will not stand by while our women are draped in scarves, while our children are mutilated, and our men are emasculated before our very people." Luxon and Campbell chatted idly while Van Dietz and other Identity Europa members. One admired Campbell's whiteboard, which read, "Free helicopter rides for commies." The helicopter ride meme, which entered far-right circles in 2016, is a reference to a practice by the Chilean and Argentine military dictates in the 1970s of executing left-wing activists by dropping them from helicopters into the ocean. Campbell acknowledges that the meme was extreme, but says, "Just because I held up a sign, I'm never going to act on it." Van Dietz deleted his Facebook page after the Unite the Right rally and has since dropped off the radar. Campbell says, but a Google Hangout video conversation made public as a part of the leak of the secret used by the group Anti-Communist Action, or ANICOM, that was publicly archived by the nonprofit news organization Unicorn Riot, offers a window into his worldview. ANICOM announced plans for a rally in Charlotte as a sequel to Unite the Right, but then canceled after celebrity white nationalist Richard Spencer withdrew. In the video, an unidentified member asked, "Do you want to bring up the group specifically that was disproportionately present in the formation of early communism?" Van Diet, sitting at a desk surrounded by maps and stacks of old books, responds, "That's an easy one, considering that Marx himself was a Jew. I have no qualms with calling them out." He turns for a copy of The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a notorious anti-Semitic forgery frequently cited by neo-Nazis that purports to expose a Jewish plot for world domination. "In fact," says Van Dietz, "I have this always with me." Later, as the group discusses the liability of James A. Field Jr.'s alleged deadly car ramming attack in Charlottesville, Van Dietz opines, "The only way to control the hysterics is to control the means of producing the hysterics, and that is through the media sensationalism that is put out through the direct palms of every individual." Another anti-com leader quips, "So what you're saying is, we should hang the Lügenpresse," the German word which translates as lying press, and was widely used in Nazi Germany. Van Dietz responds lightheartedly with a phrase that echoes Joseph Goebbels, the Third Reich propagandist's, "Our patience has run out." Prior to the Unite the Right rally in August, Passmore moved from Brown Summit to rural Stokes County. He says it was best to leave Guilford County to avoid being a Lavoid, referring to Lavoy Finium, a militia activist who was fatally shot by an Oregon State Patrol officer at a roadblock during the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge standup in January of 2016. Passmore stopped promoting the Guilford County militia after moving. He joined the Stokes County militia. Darrell Calloway, the commander of the Stokes County militia, says he counseled Passmore against going to Charlottesville, even though he appreciated that many militias went with the notable intention of protecting people and property. "They didn't have a dog in the fight," Calloway says, "but we thought it could be turned against them, and it turned out that it was." Remnants of the Guilford County militia and others who had also participated in North Carolina anti-Sharia and pro-Confederate rallies traveled to Charlottesville as a tactical unit, equipped with wooden shields bearing NC lettering, helmets, goggles, and sticks. They held Emancipation Park side by side with similarly outfitted squads from the White Nationalist Religious Worker Party, League of the South, and Vanguard America groups. Hunter Smith painted the number 14 on his shield in reference to the 14 words, a white nationalist slogan, "We must secure the existence for our people and a future for white children." The NC Shield group also included Luxton, Campbell, Becknell, and Smiley, along with Clyde Bong, a Gaston County carpenter and war veteran, and his cousin Nikita Bone, a Davidson County resident with an interest in fascist philosophy. The video shows the group holding up their shields to create a battlement of the southeast entrance to Emancipation Park, as water bottles and other projectiles flew back and forth. But they also can be seen pushing into the crowd of counter-protesters in the street in a provocative offense. Campbell says he went to Charlottesville not because he's a racist — he calls that notion laughable — and expresses sympathy for Black Lives Matter, but to defend the statue of Robert E. Lee, whom he considers an American hero, not a pillar of slavery. He believed in states' rights, as everyone should. Lee, despite the revisionism of the Lost Cause mythology, was a slave owner. He, of course, also led an army dedicated to protecting white people's right to own other human beings in a war that cost hundreds of thousands of lives. Rather than focusing on race, he says what matters to him is a federal government he considers oppressive. In his view, Governor Cooper is a tyrant, and U.S. Representative Mike Walker, a staunch conservative, is too weak-kneed when it comes to Syrian refugees. You do realize the Founding Fathers would be done shooting by now, he says. In other words, if Washington, Jefferson, and Madison found the federal government as it is now, they would have overthrown it. But he justifies his friendship with Luxton, a self-described National Socialist, in terms of personal loyalty. I like Manuel, Campbell says. He's a very nice guy, and he's very smart. There's a lot we disagree on. A lot of his political affiliations I don't agree with. I've had long conversations and disagreements with him. I know if there's ever a situation, I could call him, and he would be there to help me. To put an explanation point on their disagreement, Campbell adds, the man believes the earth is flat. Come on now. Although Passmore didn't go to Charlottesville, a week afterward he posted a photo of himself on Facebook carrying the Guilford Courthouse battle flag. In that time, anti-racist demonstrators had torn down the Confederate monument in Durham, and Bull City residents had staged a spontaneous anti-racist street rally in reaction to a threatened Klan rally. In that post, Passmore boasted that he had harassed local Antifa commies in Winston-Salem on August 18th. In the comment thread, he posted a meme that said, "Hospitalize your local Antifa scumbag." Underneath it, "You will not replace us." That slogan and a viler variant, "Jews will not replace us," were chanted at the Unite the Right rally. The same image cropped up in flyers posted to telephone poles in Durham and Chapel Hill around the same time. Passmore says his intended meaning was, "You will not replace us with socialism," though he acknowledged that racist groups are typically referring to Jews when they say it. After the Unite the Right rally, Luxton's social media posts increasingly took a turn toward violence and extremism. One cover photo celebrated the murder of Heller Heyer in Charlottesville with an image of a Dodge Challenger, the car allegedly driven by Fields. Another post depicts a grotesque caricature of a supposed Jewish man rubbing his hands together. A meme features a photo of an Orthodox Jewish man in miniature on a pizza peel being slid into the oven clay oven with the words, "Come home, chosen man." In early March, Luxton updated his Facebook profile with a photograph of Luca Triani, an Italian fascist, who went on a shooting rampage on February 3rd in Macerata, a small town in central Italy, wounding 6 migrants of African origin. Luxton also shared a meme on Gab, a social media network favored by white nationalists. That appropriates an image of Al Pacino spraying machine gun fire from the movie Scarface, along with the text, "Hell with you guys." Reached for comment, Luxton ignored a set of detailed questions, though he did reply, "I don't remember the Scarface meme, but it sounds funny." Since the Unite the Right rally, the far-right activists connected to Passmore have for the most part managed to minimize or conceal their white nationalist-backed leanings and associations enough to not raise the ire of the larger patriot militia and Second Amendment advocacy communities. Their relative discretion, coupled with a lack of discernment among many patriot militia activists, allowed Passmore and Campbell to ingratiate themselves with a South Carolina Black Lives Matter activist named Andre Gregory in April. The encounter between Gregory and the two far-right activists potentially jeopardized the Black Lives Matter activist while also escalating risks to Gregory's associates in the anti-racist militia Redneck Revolt. Gregory, the leader of Black Lives Matters in Gaffney, had forged an unlikely relationship with American Pit Vipers, a militia active in western North Carolina and upstate South Carolina that fielded armed personnel during Unite the Right, but issued a statement beforehand rejecting white nationalism and pledging to protect public safety. After the Unite the Right rally, American Pit Vipers founder Chance Allen continues to build relationships with groups and individuals on the opposite side of the political ledger, including Gregory. African-American community leaders and far-right activists from a range of organizations took part in a series of conversations in South Carolina in late August, motivated by a desire to avoid repeat of the bloodshed in Charlottesville, with particular concern surrounding debate about the future of the Confederate monument in Greenville. I was the only BLM member out there, and they had the Confederate flaggers, and they were doing their thing, Gregory recalls. I stood toe-to-toe with the flaggers by myself, and one of Allen's members seen it and reached out to me. And once us and the flaggers, we made common ground. We'd put our personal issues aside. We actually went and sat down and had a beer and lunch, and we conversed like some adults instead of like numbnuts. In October, the two groups hosted a Changing the Narrative Unity Party in Gaffney and drew representatives of the South Carolina Secessionist Party, the South Carolina Lightfoot Militia, anti-fascist groups, and a local mentoring organization. During that rally, Gregory accepted an invitation from the Secessionist Party to co-host a press conference to protest Greenville Police Chief Ken Miller. They had separate grievances. The Secessionist Party was unhappy with the police department's enforcement of a local ordinance prohibiting them from publicly displaying the Confederate flag. Gregory, meanwhile, says that during a rally calling for the removal of the Confederate monument in Greenville, Miller told him, "Go back where you came from," which Gregory took to mean Africa. Miller, who previously served as chief of police in Greensboro from 2010 to 2014, did not directly respond to these claims in a statement. Gregory declines to say anything negative about the Secessionist Party or its veneration for the Confederate flag. He and Allen both emphasize the importance of looking beyond labels and getting to know people as individuals, suggesting the Confederate flag is no different than a Black Lives Matter shirt or three-percenter patch. I can't knock them, because if I pick up the phone and say I need them, they are there in support, Gregory said. Everybody wants to separate us. Why separate when the goal is to come together and stand against the government? The Black Lives Matter Global Network noted in a statement that BLM of Gaffney is not affiliated with the network and does not have the authority to speak on behalf of the network or the work our activists are doing globally. Allen has made it his mission to broaden the Patriot Militia movement. To that end, he brought Gregory and two members of Redneck Revolt to an April 14th Second Amendment rally in Raleigh that was dominated by militia activists and three-percenters. "Our welcome mat, walking in this kind of tents for the first few minutes," Allen recalls. The next weekend, Allen brought Gregory and a small entourage of African-American activists from Gaffney to the Patriot Network Summer, a gathering outside of Winston-Salem that drew militia activists from as far away as New York, Illinois, and Georgia. The two Redneck Revolt members, notably, were not part of the entourage. As early as late January, Passmore had been monitoring social media to guard against the possibility of Redneck Revolt attending the gathering, because the group has a reputation for trying to shift militia organizations to an anti-racist or leftist stance. Gregory's reception at the summit was not altogether hospitable. Video shows that Gregory posted on Facebook two individuals who identified themselves as J.W. from the Illinois State Militia and Renee, hectoring him about his message and asking how he could claim to have unity with the Patriot movement. Gregory says the discussion was starting to draw a crowd and distracting attention from one of the event's official speakers. Gregory was flanked by a security detail, and they hustled him away so he could put on a bulletproof vest. While Gregory was away, a man wearing a Make America Great Again hat approached Gregory's friend, mistaking him for the Black Lives Matter leader. That man, Giovanni Valley of Brooklyn, came to some renown in January of 2017 after his face was slashed in a lower Manhattan bar by a man who took offense to his pro-Trump hat. Valley identifies with the Proud Boys, a street fighting outfit that is described by its founder as a pro-Western fraternal organization. Valley struck up conversation with Gregory's friend and goaded him to get on stage and give a speech. The speech, which struck soothing notes of unity and the importance of reaching beyond divisions for the sake of children, went over well, but Gregory says he thought Valley's encouragement was a trick. Contacted for this story, Gregory's friend asked that his name not be published. In an interview, Valley all but confirms Gregory's suspicions of his motives. "I told him to speak because he was being very loud," Valley says. "If you're going to speak to me, everyone may as well hear it." Valley adds that he was disappointed that Jason Kessler, who organized Unite the Right, wasn't given a platform to speak at the militia gathering. "The guy they think is a white supremacist, they didn't allow him to speak. The guy with BLM was allowed to speak. I was bothered by that." In Facebook comments, Campbell defended Gregory's presence at the summit, but Campbell's friendly posture toward Gregory is at odds with his participation in a comment thread of shortly afterwards calling attention to a photo of Gregory posing with members of Redneck Revolt. "Notice the black guy in the photo," a militia activist identified as Monk Lightfoot wrote. "He's training with a communist militia, the Redneck Revolt, so I was shocked and wondering why he was there with an armed guard. I guarantee no one did their homework on this guy." "Look at the Redneck Revolt, LOL," Passmore chimed in. "Hardcore fighters. I wonder how many memes were made from this picture." Other alumni from the NC Shield Guard piled on. Luxton posted a meme mocking Dwayne Dixon, a Redneck Revolt member from Durham, who was next to Gregory in the photo. Boomer fulminated, "Commie Monk." The same aggression directed at Redneck Revolt raises concerns about the potential for violent confrontation in a state with no shortage of such episodes, including the 1979 Greensboro Massacre, when a coalition of Nazis and Klan members drove into a black housing project and opened fire on a group of anti-racist organizers. Told about Campbell's participation in Unite the Right and his association with white nationalists, Gregory expressed surprise. "I never heard of him being involved in racism at all," Gregory said shortly after the summit. "That's news to me. He reached out to me. We talked on the phone about an hour. He wanted me to come and go shooting with him." A few weeks later, Gregory had reconsidered his opinion of Campbell. "I think he's full of nonsense. Don't say you want to bring unity, and the whole time you're a part of a white supremacist group, and you hang out with white supremacists." On a separate thread on the final day of the summit, Passmore also defended Gregory's presence, arguing that he had paid the entry fee and should enjoy the same right as anyone else to express his views. "I will fight tyranny in government with anyone by my side, and if we have differences after the tyrants are gone, then there's two ways to handle that. One is we fight later, or separate spaces and mind our own business," Passmore wrote. "Blacks and whites have different cultures. There's no denying it," Passmore explains in an interview. "I did mean it in a racial sense, or a political sense. The cultures are not the same. If people want to live separately, they should be able to live separately." Ask how he could rationalize conducting firearms training with both Black Lives Matter activists and a white nationalist, Passmore doesn't back down, mentioning Gregory, Luxton, and Smith as people he would be comfortable fighting alongside. "Our goal would be to work together as a tactical unit, so you don't oppose each other," Passmore said. "If things go down in the streets of Greensboro, those groups aren't my enemy. The tyrannical government, that is my enemy." Our next news article: bare necessities. The Durham jail's commissary charges detainees a commission on everyday items. Then the jail uses the money to pay for things advocates say the county should be providing anyway. Ask almost anyone who spent time in the Durham County Detention Facility what it's like, and you'll hear three things. The food sucks. It's cold. And items for sale in the commissary are overpriced. These complaints are related. Still hungry after dinner? Head to the commissary for an 80-cent pack of Raymond chili. Buy a $6 thermal shirt. During a public hearing last week on the proposed county budget, five speakers complained that this system places a double burden on people in jail, a large percentage of whom are being held pre-trial, not only because they have to pay for this stuff, but because a portion of each sale goes toward what's called the Inmate Welfare Fund, which is used to pay for other items and services in the jail. My concern is not where the money is going, but rather where this money is coming from, Delvin Davis told the Durham Board of Commissioners. Ultimately, what we have now is a regressive tax that disproportionately costs people of color and criminalizes poverty. We're essentially asking people in poverty to pay money toward improving jail conditions. But if not for their poverty, they could afford not to be locked up in the first place. He and other speakers raised questions about how Inmate Welfare Fund dollars are generated and spent. These questions grew out of an inquiry into jail contracts by Southerners on New Ground, an LGBTQ organization working to end money bail in Durham and other southern cities. Since 2010, the fund has averaged about $120,000 in revenue and $113,000 in expenditure a year, although it has, within the last decade, collected as much as $351,000 and spent as little as $37,000. The Durham County Sheriff's Office, which oversees the jail, did not clarify why the numbers vary so dramatically. Advocates at last week's hearing asked county commissioners for three things: that purchases currently made with the funds be covered by tax revenue, and that they end the fund's commission system on commissary purchases and keep prices as low as possible, and that they audit the fund and related contracts. Sheriff's office policy dictates that money in the fund can only be used on behalf of the inmates' welfare for items or services that directly benefit the inmates. There's currently $381,012 available for future expenditures benefiting the jail population, says David McNulty, finance manager for the sheriff's office. Per the policy, inmate welfare fund dollars can be used for things like television, athletic supplies, books, magazines, barbershop supplies, and instruments, as well as programming for detainees. The largest chunk goes to the Durham Literacy Center for GED and life skills courses, $53,000 so far this fiscal year. According to 224 pages of invoices reviewed by the Indy, the Inmate Welfare Fund has also been used this year to purchase toiletries, shoes, bedding, towels, and legal books for detainees. Last July, the sheriff's office spent $2,105.76 on 300 towels and $2,112.35 on 963 pairs of shower shoes. 30 yellow rain suits cost $387.30 in April. 45 basketballs totaled $989.55. 600 safety sheets designed to mitigate the risk of hanging cost $3,964.70. The fund was also used to purchase books of Supreme Court opinions and North Carolina laws for the Defension Center Library, as well as copies of the Bible and the Koran, $631.76, and a Herald Sun subscription. I was shocked to see that the fund was being used to pay for blankets, sheets, towels, shower shoes. Why is that not being provided by the regular cost of running the jail? Asked Judy Kincaid, part of Song's jail contract research team. Are they going to charge them for the tables and the chairs they sit on next? The average daily population of the jail declined from 560 in 2012 to 480 last year. Yet in the same time frame, the inmate welfare fund grew. Since welfare's fiscal year 2015, revenues had increased from $118,000 to $139,000, despite a 26 contract eliminating phone call commissions that had also gone into the fund. The amount of the commissary commission depends on the item. For most items, a 26% commission is built into the price. Other items, such as fresh food and care packages, can be ordered for detainees. They have a 10% commission. Stamps and more expensive offerings like radios, which cost $24.99, are commission-free, according to McNulty. According to a 2016 request for proposals to operate the commissary, detainees spent $491,309.05 on commissary items in 2015, the most popular being jalapeno-flavored Cheetos, chicken ramen, and stamps. A sales report breaks this down to an average of $982 per detainee, a figure those concerned about the Infant Welfare Fund have used to highlight the burden these costs places on people who don't have access to a few hundred dollars to make bail. But the calculation is flawed, dividing total sales by a jail population on a single day. With 9,910 people booked into jail in 2015, the real per detainee average is closer to $49 in commissary purchases. Still, speakers at last Monday's hearing said more items should be provided for free, and those that are truly supplemental should be sold for minimal cost. Right now, the 2.5-ounce Colgate toothpaste sold in the commissary, which is operated by Aramac, costs $2.78, but each tube costs $1.24 when bought in bulk online from distributor Bob Barker Incorporated. Irish Spring Soap is listed for $1.44 on the commissary menu. It is 72 cents on the Bob Barker website. Some basic hygiene items are provided to detainees. Davis, an analyst with the Center for Responsible Lending, told commissioners that of the 7,187 people held in jail in 2016, 1,732 had bonds of $5,000 or less, including 201 of bonds of $1,000 or less. If we can't pay to get out of jail, how can we possibly pay for our own care? Andrea Hudson, a community activist who has spent time in Durham jail, asked commissioners. We can't. So we put that extra burden on our family members who send us money. We turn now to the indie food section. Good things in small packages. Special treats. A Chapel Hill chocolate shop helps people with disabilities one truffle at a time. It's not unusual for chocolate shops to be intimate. Diminutive treats like bonbons and truffles don't take up much room, and unless a shop has a production kitchen on site, there's no need for sweeping space. So, when Dan Friedman, a former real estate investment manager, noticed that the smallest space in Chapel Hill's Timberland Shopping Center was vacant, he saw it as a perfect place to start a business with his adult son, Alex. Alex has hyperlexia, an autism-related syndrome characterized by an unusually high reading ability, offset by deficits in verbal communication. As is the case for many people with disabilities, finding a job can be difficult. With Special Treats, which opened in August of 2017, Friedman envisaged a way to semi-retire, spend more time with Alex, and provide a steady and fulfilling job for him and others with disabilities. The shop may be small, but it's got the biggest heart around. Special Treats products are sourced from nonprofits that employ people with disabilities. Main supplier, Chocolate Spectrum, is run by a professional chocolatier in Florida, who is also a speech and language therapist and an autism expert. Her disabled employees receive training and help turn out the gourmet truffles that line Special Treats display case, including flavors like dulce de leche, coconut lime, and blueberry lemon. Pennsylvania's Highland Chocolates primarily employs with people with Down syndrome and produces treats like almond bark, pretzel bark, and the uber-popular tree stumps, a chocolate-covered mini pretzel sandwiching caramel and peanut butter. Recently, Canada Noble Chocolates from Nutty Spitefs, a Vermont company that employs people with disabilities, have been flying off the shelves. The dark chocolates are made with a non-psychoactive compound of the cannabis plant, read, "These will not get you high," and are available in 13-milligram heart-shaped chocolates and 90-milligram bars. In addition to chocolate, Freeman sells candies and soaps from Chapel Hill's Extraordinary Ventures, where Alex used to work. Alex moved to Florida with his mother a few months after the shop's opening, but Special Treats continues to be a sought-after place for people with disabilities to work. "We've always had plenty of people who want to work here," Friedman says. "The unemployment rate for people with disabilities is very high. There are always people with autism, Down syndrome, and physical disabilities looking for work, typically part-time, which works well for the store, too." Special Treats is also earning a reputation as a boutique coffee shop, particularly for last-minute Valentine's Day gifts, among shoppers who like its mission. But they keep asking if any of the confections were made locally. Until recently, the answer was no. "Many of our customers like the idea of products made locally by people with disabilities. It adds another layer or favorable quality to the product," Freeman says. Even without a place to make product and without a working knowledge of chocolate making, Friedman's entrepreneurial spirit and dedication fueled him to persevere. During his research, he discovered Piedmont Food and Agricultural Processing Center, a Hillsboro-based nonprofit that is an incubator for new food businesses. In addition to having a commercial kitchen, including a chocolate tempering machine, PFAP provided vital resources for training, ingredient sourcing, safety and health requirements, and packaging and design. Friedman's first creations were called Whiskey Crackers, round, buttery crackers deep in semi-sweet chocolate and topped with Tennessee whiskey-infused pecan chips. It took months of recipe testing and informal taste testing. Friedman plays in two local bands, and his bandmates were eager testers, in order to strike the perfect balance between sweet and savory, creamy and crunchy. It also took time for Friedman and his kitchen manager, Paul Parsons, a legally disabled man with a previous restaurant experience, to figure out scaling production, finding the right blade for chipping the pecans without pulverizing them, and mastering the chocolate tempering machine. The duo works at PFA's kitchen from 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. Thankfully, Parsons also makes a mean cup of coffee. Another hurdle was making sure the whiskey crackers were alcohol-free. Although the whiskey imparts a subtle flavor, all the booze is cooked off. To ensure that the treats were certified alcohol-free, a requirement for labeling, Labelin worked with NC State Foods Lab to conduct an analysis. "One of my most exciting days as a chocolate maker was when an inspector from the Department of Agriculture watched us make a batch of whiskey crackers and signed off," Freeman says. "It meant I could sell whiskey crackers to the public. I think we have a hit on our hands." Saxapaw General Store is already placed in order. Freeman is in discourse with place them in other specialty shops. He hopes his product will be in Southern shelves by this fall. In addition to whiskey crackers, Friedman makes flavored popcorn in combination with dark chocolate espresso and maple bacon chipotle. He's also developing a chocolate coffee bark using Gabby's Grounds coffee beans, a special blend made by local roaster Larry's Coffee for Gabby Angelini, a young woman with Down syndrome who is selling it to raise funds to open a Raleigh coffee shop that will employ others with disabilities. Friedman also sells bags of Gabby's ground coffee in his shop. On what it means to him to be able to help other people with disabilities, both through his shop and by supporting like-minded businesses, Friedman says, "It's been one of those things when you do something to help other people in the community, and it ends up helping you." This week's Indy also has a couple of items on public notices. The North Carolina Department of Transportation is proposing to make improvements to U.S. 64 from just west of Laurel Duncan Road in Apex to U.S. 1 in Cary. The public meeting will be held at the Summit Church located at 3000 Lufkin Road in Apex on Thursday, June 21st from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. The purpose of this meeting is to provide interested citizens with information on the project and gather public input on the proposed design. Also, the North Carolina Department of Transportation proposes to widen North Carolina 54 from Shiloh Glen Drive to Perimeter Park Drive and provide additional turn lanes in the town of Morrisville. A public meeting will be held at the Hyatt House, located at 10962 Chapel Hill Road, on Monday, June 25th, 2018, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. and 5 to 7 p.m. The purpose of this meeting is to inform the public of the project and to gather public input on the proposed design. As information becomes available, it may be viewed online at the North Carolina Department of Transportation public meeting webpage, www.northcarolina.gov projects public meetings. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will also be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.